course of the rest of this week. So thanks, Adrian. It's a great pleasure for me to be here. I am very fond of the University of Toronto, of the Fields Institute. I have many, many friends here. It's particularly meaningful for me to be giving this course here in Toronto. The problems being discussed are what are called in the Pfefferman household by the family, the Toronto problem. I got involved in it first roughly 10, 12 years ago when I went to a lecture by Ed Bierstone on the Toronto problem, and the moment I heard the statement of the problem, I couldn't stop thinking about it, and that continues until this moment. Let's see. Now, what am I doing in this particular meeting? And the answer is that Slava Kurilev heard some of the early results on the problem and had the feeling that this subject may well tie in to inverse problems. And so from my point of view, knowing a little bit about inverse problems, my first reaction is, well, I don't immediately see how, but it's possible and it's certainly worth exploring. And so I hope that you find these lectures interesting, and there is a chance that there is a connection. Let's find out. Okay, so what are the problems? The problems go back to a series of papers by Whitney in 1934. So let me just state a few problems. We're working with functions on Rn, and let's pick our space of functions, and let's, for the moment, let's pick Cm of Rn. So we're going to work with, let's say, real-valued m times continuously differentiable functions, etc. When I write this, I mean that the function and its derivatives of order up to m are bounded. Okay, so there is a Cm norm on Rn. All right, and so we're interested in such functions. Okay, now Whitney asked the following. Suppose that we're given a set E in Rn. So we're given E, and we're given a function f from E to R. Okay, real-valued function on E. And the interesting thing, well, an interesting aspect of Whitney's question is that this E is given, but it's completely arbitrary. You assume nothing about it. Okay, and now the question is how can we decide whether there exists an F in Cm of Rn that agrees with the given function on the set E? Okay. Well, if there is no such function, then if we can at least discover that there is no such function, then our story ends. But if there is such a function, f, if such f exists, then we ask, how small can we take the norm? I guess I didn't write down the norm. The norm is defined to be the sup x in Rn of, let's say, the max over multi-indices less than or equal to m d alpha f of x. Okay, how small can we take the norm? What can we say about the derivatives of f at some given point? And obviously alpha less than or equal to m, since the function f is only m times differentiable. Okay, what can we say about that? Can we take f to depend linearly on little f? Okay, now these are the questions These are the questions for arbitrary sets E. There is, I hope to show you not all details, but at least some of the main ideas. These questions have been answered. Okay, there was sporadic progress over a long time. The people who contributed are first of all Whitney, who solved the one-dimensional case and proved the Whitney extension theorem, which is a complete solution to an easier version of this problem that I'll describe later in the talk. Okay, there it stood from 1934 until the late 50s, and as far as I know, there was no significant progress. Whitney's work had a great influence on analysis, which I'll describe a little bit, but I think people stopped thinking about the question as far as I know. Then in the 50s, Georges Glaeser had a wonderful set of geometrical ideas and gave a geometrical solution to the case M equals 1, so for the case of C1 of Rn, okay? And he introduced a geometrical construction. I forget what name he gave it. I'm going to call it Glaeser refinement. Okay, now, working in isolation in the, so this is, this was 1934, this is 1958, the 70s until, I think, until maybe the 2000s, mathematicians working together in isolation in the former Soviet Union and then in freedom in Israel, Pavel Schwarz, oh wait, alphabetical order, Yuri Brudny and Pavel Schwarzman. Invented the idea of a finiteness principle. And a finiteness principle says that for certain problems, if you can look at little subproblems of a big problem, and if you can understand all of those uniformly in the choice of the little subproblem, then you can understand the big problem. And that's much too vague for it to be of any use, but I will actually state finiteness principles soon enough. So you'll see them. Brudny and Schwarzman were working in originally in isolation and were trying to construct what Whitney was talking about and did not have access to his papers and guessed that this is what he did, although it wasn't. Okay. Let's see. All right. Then in maybe 2000 or so, maybe 2000, 2001, let's see, there was a very important paper by Ed Bierstone, Pierre Milman, who are sitting here, and Wiesław Pawłuski. In which they discovered the correct notion, or very close to the correct notion, of Glaeser refinement for CM of Rm. Okay, and so they solved a variant of this problem in the case in which the set E is subanalytic. But in particular, they introduced a definition which extended Glaeser's definition and applied to the case of CM of Rn. And it was natural to conjecture that in fact, although subanalytic sets helped one to prove the theorem, that in fact this gave the necessary and sufficient condition and gave the complete solution to this problem in the general case. It turned out, all right, then, so then from, I don't know, 2002 or to now, to 2007 or so. I worked further on this, and I'm going to try to explain the solution to all of these problems. It turns out that this notion had to be very slightly modified in order to apply to the general case. So a slight modification of this solves the general case, and so these problems are all solved. Okay, but now the story is not over because, well, so there are various other natural directions. Let me talk first about the one that is conceivably relevant to inverse problems, which is the effective finite version of Whitney's problem. So in the effective finite version, we are given a finite set E. So E is in Rn, so we fix Mn greater than or equal to 1, and again we work in Cm of Rn. But this time, let's say we're given E finite. And so the number of points of E is, let's say, capital N. And I'd like you to imagine that M, little m and little n are fixed. Think of, I don't know, C3 of R2 or something like that. But capital N is enormous. Capital N is 100 billion. Okay? And we're given a function f from E to R, or maybe F takes E to some Banach space. And fortunately, it actually doesn't matter so much where the target is. Maybe I'll come back to that point, but for the moment, let's just deal with real-valued functions. And so before I write anything else, let me say, we would like to find functions capital F that agree with little f, but are smooth. Now, of course, if E is finite, of course there are functions that agree perfectly, but they could be very wild. So let me draw two alternative pictures on the board. So let's say I would like to fit a function y equals f of x to some data. So let me compare two problems. In the first problem, the data are like that. Okay? So there are some data points, and our problem is to pass a smooth curve through those points. And now here's the second problem. You get the idea. Okay? With any luck, well, some of these points are lines. yes. Imagine that each of these is just a point. And now the goal is to pass a C3 function through those data points. Now, of course you can do it, but the price you will pay is that the C3 norm of the interpolant is going to be enormous. And so I'd like to be able to distinguish whether we have a situation like this or a situation like this. Furthermore, when we're fitting data when we're fitting a smooth function to data, the data are often imperfect. So it's a mistake to ask that capital F should agree perfectly with little f. We should have, as every experimentalist knows, we should have observed values and error bars. So let me introduce the error bars, okay? And so let's say we have a function. We're given all this stuff. We're given a finite set. We're given a function on the finite set. Those are the observed values of whatever it is we're trying to understand. And we're given the error bars, and that's a function from E to the non-negative reals. Okay? And so now what we're trying to do is we seek a function f in Cm of Rn, and well, numbers M1 and M2 such that, first of all, the CM norm, let me start writing, the CM norm is less than or equal to, let's say, M1, and so the CM norm is at most M1, and furthermore, this F agrees with the data in the sense that if you take one of the points of E, you are within M2 standard deviations. Okay, and so we'd like to do this, and it may or may not be possible, and we ask for which M1 and M2 is this possible? And if it is possible, then compute the F, compute an F that goes with the given M1 and M2. Okay? Now, this is a basic problem. This is a basic applied problem. The world is full of data, and we would like to fit functions to data. We'd like to learn. Oh, oops, sorry. Thank you. Okay, right. The world is full of data. We would like to try to get information from our data. We would try to learn something. And one natural hypothesis is that the functions we're trying to come up with are reasonably smooth in some sense. And so this is, I believe, a basic applied problem. And if this could be solved by efficient algorithms that could be implemented on computers, I believe it would be of great practical importance. I'm going to show you, all right, so that motivates the effective finite version of the thing. I'm going to show you some theorems and sketch some algorithms, and they, except for one nettlesome point, they completely optimally solve this problem, which would then, I believe, be of real practical importance in the world. Unfortunately, some constants are too big, and I have been working and plan to continue working to beat the constants down. But in any event, so this is the effective finite version of these problems. A small technical point, I would like to, from now on, I would like to take M1 equals M2. That happens to be convenient mathematically. The way I've stated the problem, that's an extremely strange idea, right? Why should the number of standard deviations be the same as the bound on the smoothness? But the simple observation is, I didn't tell you what sigma is. And if, I can always change the value of M2 by simply rescaling sigma. And therefore, without loss of generality, I can ask this question with M1 equals M2. Yeah. The size of little f. Okay, so, I want to take these guys as small as possible. So if the little f is very bad, then I will find that I can only solve this problem for very big M1 and M2. So first question, for which M1, M2 is this possible? Well, if the little f is very big or not very smooth, or if I have a situation like the upper right, then this problem will only be solvable when M1 and M2 are big. Okay, but whether I'm in the situation on the left or the situation on the right, once I decide which is an essentially optimal M, then I can And of course, yes, oh yes, it depends on the choice of the problem. So in other words, given all the... I'm sorry? Oh. Oh, all right. So in fact, I would propose to do the following. Let me erase these boards and give a different formulation, which I claim is logically equivalent to this, and which I think will answer your concern. Okay? So let me... All right, now that I know the secret, let's see what we can do. All right, so I'm going to define, So we seek functions capital F in CM of Rn and positive real numbers M such that the following condition holds. The following two conditions hold. First of all, the norm of F in CM Rn is less than or equal to m, and f of x minus the data is less than or equal to m times sigma of x for all x in the data set E. And I'm going to define, so we would like to find them, but if, for example, if m is too small, if we are greedy, this may not exist. And so I'm going to define F E sigma. I'm going to define a norm, and this is defined to be the inf of all M such that there exists F, for which there exists F such that F and M satisfy the condition in the box. For example, let's take sigma to be identically zero, okay? That means we demand that our interpolants, capital F, agree perfectly with the data. And in that case, let me raise the blackboard. Right. So, for example, suppose that sigma is zero. This norm is simply the inf of the CM norm of functions on the whole space that agree perfectly with the data. Okay? And now, problems. Compute this norm. And compute an interpolant F, let's say compute Fm satisfying the condition in the box with M close to the least possible value. Okay, so now some norm of F appears explicitly. Is everybody happy with that? Okay. I should say... Oh, what a good question. What a good question. So now let me... All right. Thank you. All right. So there are several clarifications needed to make this problem precise. Let me address that one. That was very high on the list. What the hell does it mean to compute a function? So First of all, what does it mean to compute anything? What have we got? I have in mind using a computer. Now, we're proving theorems, so I have to tell you in some formal sense what a computer is. So a computer is what von Neumann said it was in his specifications way back when. When one can read, you know, so there is a RAM. the RAM has memory cells. In each memory cell, you can store an integer or a real number. Well, in fact, you can store finitely many bits. Let's say for purposes of this lecture that in one memory cell you can store one real number to perfect accuracy. That's, of course, an idealization. And in fact, in the work that I'm going to describe, by the way, I should give credit to my co-author, the stuff on the finite case is joint work with Boaz Klartog, with whom it was a great pleasure to work. So we have a computer. It has registers. It has RAM. It can do elementary arithmetic operations, etc., etc., etc. Okay, that's a computer. A computer operation means add two numbers together, or take the contents of a register and store it in a given memory location, or fetch the contents of a given memory location and put the resulting number or bit pattern or whatever it is into one of the registers. That's what I mean by one computer operation. Okay? Okay. Now, all right. What does it mean to compute with numbers? Well, somebody gives you a computer program, an algorithm, and the computer executes the computer program, and either it tries to divide by zero or something, in which case it generates an error, or you get out a number. Okay, so now we know how to compute with numbers. Now, that's all very nice, but what does it mean to compute a function? And I'm going to give the following definition and then criticize it, and then explain why the criticism doesn't bother us. Okay? So, there's going to be a dialogue with the computer. We input the data. For us, the data will be a set E. First of all, the data will be the numbers M and N specifying the space we're working in. Then a finite set E. It's a finite set of points in Rn, so we can enter a finite number of real numbers at our keyboard and enter the set E. Similarly, we enter F, we enter G, and then we press go. On the computer screen appears a message. Thank you for using the system. Please wait. Okay? The computer then executes an algorithm, which I'm going to call the one-time work. And when it is done, then from the point of view of the machine, if I can endow it with consciousness, from the point of view of the machine, there is an interpolant, capital F, that it has already computed. And then when it is done with the one-time work, the computer prints on the screen, thank you for your patience. I have now produced the interpolant capital F. Now, if that were the end of the process, we could be reminded of the American election cycle now in progress. But instead, the process doesn't end there. We then query the machine. So we can address a query to the machine, and the machine will respond to our queries. What is a query, and what is the response to a query? A query is simply a point in Rn. So a query is a query. There is a query point, let's say x underbar in Rn. So simply in the notation I got used to, putting that bar underneath means it has to do with a query. So we enter a query point. The computer says, aha, that's your question. Just a moment, I will produce the answer. The computer then executes a query response algorithm, which draws on the information that it produced during its one-time work, and it then outputs to you not only the function value, but all the derivatives of f at the query point, up to order little m, and those are the only derivatives you have any right to expect, because the function that it is trying to compute is a CM function. Okay? So the process is you enter the data, the computer executes one-time work, it then declares that it's ready for queries, you can enter a query point, and it will respond to your query by producing the function and its derivatives up to order m at the query point. That's what I mean by computing a function. Now, of course, computations might be wasteful or efficient, and so we need to address that point. But let me put that off for a moment, and let me instead just describe, or let me criticize this definition of computing a function, and then let me respond to my own criticism. Okay, what's wrong with this? And the answer is, this is much too tough. In practice, according to this definition, virtually no functions are computable. For example, let's say we want to compute a Bessel function. Well, if we want to compute a Bessel function, what do we do? It's highly unlikely that using a finite amount of arithmetic, we can get the exact value of the Bessel function. Instead, we get a very, very good approximation, which we proceed to use. I'm demanding here that the function and its derivatives up to some order can be computed perfectly by doing a finite amount of arithmetic. So this is a very, very tough definition of computing functions, so tough that in practice, very few of the functions we really care about are computable. Okay? And now my response to my own criticism is, that's okay, because the algorithms that I'm going to talk about compute an interpolant in this sense. And if the task I set myself is much too hard and I carry it out, that's okay. All right? So there will be a theorem, I'll state as a theorem that a certain algorithm to be sketched later in the lectures, a certain algorithm will compute an interpolant in this sense. Hi, Pierre. Sure. That's a very good question. Okay, if you actually want, very little. Okay, if you actually want to make M as small as possible, typically it doesn't exist. This norm was defined as an inf. Typically, in simple examples, it's an inf, not a minimum. So then you could take an M which is a little bit bigger than the inf, and we'll talk about how much bigger than the inf. And in that case, then F is not at all unique. So that's part of the reason why we can compute F with a finite amount of arithmetic. We have freedom in picking an F that's easy to compute. Yeah? Please. Okay.
Then are the possible x that you could find?
Yes.
If you put the x that you picked in that ball.
Yes.
The data in the ball, and you want to compute that in that ball.
Yes.
There are many x, there's no unique.
Sure.
Is it close to, are the answers you can get close to each other?
Okay, so let's say the data are all in a tiny ball. If you put a query point in the tiny ball, depending in turn on exactly how you put the data, suppose you have a shotgun and you fire a lot of bullets into this ball, then the F is sort of almost unique inside the ball. Okay, so in fact I'll get to that. So how, right, and the next, once. Once I stop burbling about this, the next thing I'll burble about will in fact be precisely that. But all right, let me now discuss what it means for an algorithm to be efficient. It's not going to be very interesting if I can compute things in principle, but the algorithms that compute them require so many computer operations that the universe will collapse before the computer finishes.
More than American debt.
I'm sorry?
More than American debt.
Yes. Okay. So here are the computer resources that we need to keep track of. First of all, there is the one-time work. How many computer operations were needed for the one-time work? Secondly, when we enter a query, the computer has to execute an algorithm to answer the query. Okay, how many computer operations are needed for that algorithm? And thirdly, how much storage is needed by the computer for the whole business? Okay. How many memory cells must the RAM contain in order to be able to carry out the algorithm? So there are three numbers that we need to keep track of. Okay. Let's see. Oh, one more point. I'm always interested in the case in which E here is either completely general or finite, but otherwise completely general. I do not want to make any assumptions on the geometry of the set E. So, for example, it might be natural for many applications to think that E looks something like a lattice. And so I'm given function values on a lattice, and and then from there I want to interpolate a nice smooth function. That problem is much, much, much easier than the general case. When I make no geometrical assumptions about what the set E looks like, other than perhaps that it's finite, that gives the problem several orders of magnitude more bite, and I'd like to give examples to show why. All right, but let me put that off. All right. The next thing that I would like to discuss is Spiro's question, how unique is this thing? So I would like to make a definition and then illustrate it. Okay. So am I right? The questions are clear. Okay. Oh, wait, before I address Spiro's question, let me mention one other thing. I would like to think of this as ultimately being someday of practical use. If we're going to apply this to real data, then there's an important point to be remembered about real data. It's very, very seldom correct, even with error bars. On a bad day, your equipment didn't work, or you didn't drink enough coffee and you wrote the wrong number down in the lab book or something. There are outliers. So it would be helpful if you could take this number and answer the following question. Suppose that I don't believe that I should be trying to approximate little f on all points of E. I should be able to throw away 100 points of E. Okay? And I will be guided, since I don't know on which of my 100 data points are the completely ridiculous ones. What I would like to do is discard 100 points of E in such a way as to minimize this guy. Which 100 points should I throw away, and how small can I make this guy? That's a significant question, and I'll be addressing that in the mini course. Okay. Okay. So outliers. Okay. Now, Spiros's question. I'd like to formulate the question. All right, let me make just a little bit of notation. Suppose we have a CM function f, and we have a point x. Let me say that jxf, that's the jet of f at x, this is simply the mth, or sometimes the m minus first, depending on the particular application, order Taylor polynomial of f at x. Okay? So that's JF at X. And now let me define, suppose that we're given this situation, Okay? Let me define a set which is unfortunately going to be called sigma, even though this function is called sigma. So let me define sigma of XE. And that is the set of all jets at X of functions F such that the norm of F in CM of Rn is less than or equal to M. And f of x minus little f of x, whoops, I'm sorry, little f of y minus little f of y is less than or equal to m sigma of y for all y in E. So I look, gamma of x m, sorry, gamma of XM, yes, sorry. Sigma will come later. Gamma of XM. So what does this mean? This is Spira's question, right? Suppose that I have a function F that agrees with the data and has a certain smoothness. What can I say about the function and its derivatives at a given point? And, well, what I can say about it is precisely that it belongs to this set gamma. And so the problem is to compute gamma of Xm. And, well, what does it mean to compute gamma of Xm? And I'll say in a few minutes. Let me illustrate with a few examples. Okay, let me illustrate these examples, these ideas with a few examples. Okay, so in the first example, let me take a car trip. Okay, my position is a function of time. I'm driving on a road, and so my position is given as a single function of one variable. I know when I start out, and I know when I end up, and every few minutes, I notice where I am, and I know approximately where I am. Also, I am driving my old car, which is capable only of a certain acceleration, and let's say of a certain velocity. And so there is a bound on its C2 norm. Maybe there are particular moments at which I know exactly where I am. You know, I know exactly where I started out. And so at time zero, I know exactly the value of the function. And at other times, perhaps I know some more, I know a bit less. And then I ask, at a given moment, which may or may not be one of the moments at which I made an observation, I ask, what can I say about my position, my velocity, and my acceleration? Okay. And that's exactly the problem of computing the gamma. Now, at least when there are no error bars present, when this sigma is equal to zero, this is an old and venerable subject in pure and applied math. This is interpolation, okay? And so we have some data points. They may or may not be evenly spaced, and we do that. These are the given function values. We want to match them perfectly, and one can do quite a good job with splines. Okay, so you look at a few consecutive points, you find a polynomial that passes through them. You then move to the next set of consecutive points, and you find some other polynomial that passes through them. But of course, it doesn't agree so very well. I mean, it doesn't agree perfectly in between the points. But with a suitable partition of unity, for example, one can put these together, or there's a multiplicity of elementary tricks which let you make the transition in such a way that you can make an essentially optimal interpolant, and the CM norm of this thing is as small as possible, and you can easily compute it. And to compute it someplace, you only need to look at a few points, and you know which few points you need to look at. Okay, am I right? That's clear. That's in one dimension. Now, of course, if you introduce the sigma, then it's a different story. So, for instance, suppose Suppose that I tell you, I take a car trip, and I tell you with an error of 1 meter where I am every billionth of a second. Okay, then I can do a pretty good job of figuring out my velocity, but I don't do it by looking at consecutive times. That would be terrible, right? Imagine two times that differ by a billionth of a second, and I measure with an accuracy of 1 meter where I am at each of them, and if I make an error in different directions of 1 meter, I'm going to be, you know, that's going to be completely wrong. So already in one dimension, if I introduce the sigma, this takes a little bit of thought, but that's nothing. Okay, that's the one-dimensional case. When we go from functions of one variable to functions of several variables, okay, that brings in new and troubling questions. So let me produce some examples. And remember, I want to be able to understand every possible set E. So in the first example, what I'm going to be drawing on the board are different sets E. I'm not going to be talking yet about functions on E. Just this is the set E itself, and for the moment we're in the plane. All right. So let's say that our set E consists of an awful lot of, let's say, evenly spaced points on the line, on the x-axis, let's say. That's our set E. Well, that's basically a one-dimensional problem, and imagine that I give you a function on these dots, and I want to match them perfectly. That's a one-dimensional problem. Now let me take one of these dots and move it just a little bit. That's not a one-dimensional problem. That's a two-dimensional problem. Suppose that I am here. Okay. Well, if I look at these three points, I can get information about the function value and its derivative in the horizontal direction and its derivative in the vertical direction. Suppose that I'm here, and I want to know, what can I say about my interpolating function? Well, if I look very nearby, there is no information about what's going on in the y direction. But if I come over here, I know that the derivative, let's say the y derivative of my interpolant, can be guessed at this point. And if I think that my interpolant is at least C2, and if these points are rather close together, I have information about the vertical derivative here. Okay? But it is, so information is in, information about the y derivative is available, but it comes only if I look at this one point. I had better know to look at this one point. This point is special. I'd better know that. My computer program had better know that. Notice that this point may be very close to this point, but these guys may be very closely spaced, so this may not be one of the 10,000 closest points to this one. So any algorithm that I choose, I mean, any algorithm that I try to use to interpolate that looks only at the 10,000 nearest neighbors of this point is bound to have nothing to do with the correct answer. Okay? So there are delicate cases, and it's something as simple as that, there are delicate cases in which trivial algorithms are bound to produce garbage. Now, this is the simplest version of the new and troubling questions. Let me draw a fancier version of the same thing. This is supposed to be an algebraic curve, the zero set of one polynomial of low degree, let's say of degree 3. Can a polynomial degree, can it look like that? Degree 3, good, thank you. Okay, all right, and now imagine that, let's say we have a lot of points, I don't know whether what should be happening near there, but again, if we just take one point and we move it away from the curve, the same phenomenon happens, okay? Because if f is an interpolant, so is f plus p, let's say this is a set where p is 0, and that would happen, except at this point, okay? So can you distinguish between capital F, which you think is an interpolant, and capital F plus p, and you are completely shafted unless you know to look at this point, because this point is important. Okay, but now, of course, in the real problem, nobody draws this nice algebraic curve for you. Instead, you are given a set of dots. And if it happens that there is some algebraic curve lying around, which is, let's say, close to all of the dots, but very close to all but one of the dots, you had better detect that real fast, or you are just going to produce the wrong answer. Okay? Something close to the full generality of the problem. Let's imagine we're in Rn, and I'm going to tell you a set E, a large finite set E, for which this interpolation problem is delicate. Okay? So let's be in R3. All right? So in R3, let me produce, all right, let's take one surface, which is the zero set of some low degree polynomial. There it is. Okay? And let's imagine that all of my data points are very, very close to that surface. But there is a second polynomial, and when we take the zero set of that second polynomial on the first, on the surface that I talked about before, maybe we get something like that. Okay. Let's add this. Maybe this has some singularities. Here's a simple thing. Okay. So these two curves together are a one-dimensional set sitting inside the two-dimensional set. And let's imagine that most but not all of my data points are very close to this guy. So they're extremely close to the surface, and they're very close to one of these two curves, or to the union of these two curves, although not so close as they are to the surface. All right. You had better detect that, and all of, I mean, that sort of structure has the same kind of influence on the problem as I just described for the most trivial case. And so if something like this is happening everywhere, or let's say locally in some neighborhood of a particular size, we had better detect it, and we had better detect this condition and respond to it. And if we cannot do that, then we cannot solve the interpolation problem for the most general finite sets. We are stuck making geometrical assumptions, which for practical problems, one might want to do. But if you want to understand in general, this rears its head. This is just the sort of problem for which one is led to blow up singularities. And in fact, when Bierstone, Milman, and Pavlovsky studied the Whitney problem for infinite sets, they blew up singularities. I believe that there is a relationship between the stuff that I'm going to tell you and algebraic geometry. That's easy to say. I mean, not many people really understand the stuff that I'm going to tell you, and certainly I do not know at all algebraic geometry on the level that would be needed to make sense of that remark to decide whether it's bullshit or wise. But I think there is a connection to algebraic geometry in this subject. Okay. Yes. All right. Now let me think. Okay. Have I asked all the questions? No. Let me mention two more questions, then let me start to make things a little more precise. Okay. Yes. Okay. So, what other questions might we ask? Well, at the very beginning, I said, let's work in the space CM of Rn. CM of Rn is only one reasonable space of functions. Let me mention two others. There's, let's say, CM alpha of Rn, functions whose derivatives up to order m are Lipschitz alpha, or more generally, let's say, CM omega of Rn, where this omega is a modulus of continuity. Okay. Or I could look at Sobolev spaces. So these are functions whose derivatives up to order m belong to LP in Rn. Okay. And one can ask the analogous questions for these spaces. For these guys, in fact, the analysis of these spaces is very much tied up to the analysis of CM, and the papers that I mentioned treat them as well, and so the solution of the problem for CM, of Whitney's original problem for CM, involves as one step solving this problem, okay, and they're analogs of the finite effective version of the problem. For these guys, and I would say they're in good shape. Okay, here progress is just beginning, and let's say a couple of years ago the story would have been, gee, wouldn't it be lovely to know anything about these? And now finally, by work of Schwarzman, and a couple of young people and me. So the young people are Aryeh Israel and Garvin, Kevin Lulli, me. Some basic theorems for these problems on Sobolev spaces are known. Algorithms are not yet available, but there is a lot of hope. The problem is now wide open and likely to be solved in the next few years. So I'd like to be able to explain something like that. Let's see. Okay, maybe I stop there in stating the problems. I had in mind that maybe these lectures should in general include a break. The next ones will. We have half an hour to go. Rather than there being a break, what I think I'll do is explain a little bit in what sense some of these problems get solved, and I think I will finish at, let's say, a quarter of 12 in lieu of there having been a break. Okay. For the next lectures, I have in mind that about halfway through we have a 5 or 10 minute break. Okay. All right. So let's see. All right. So remember what we're trying to do for the effective finite version. We'd like to compute this norm. We'd like to compute an F which is approximately best possible in the sense that it serves with the best possible M. All right, well, we'd like to, but if you want to know exactly the best possible M in the sense of computing this norm perfectly, I don't know how to do that. I worked very hard to be able to compute it essentially perfectly in the simplest non-trivial case, which is C2 of R2 and in the general case, I'm stuck. So in what sense will I compute it? Well, in
for arbitrary
E and arbitrary F. Yes. Okay. So let me explain in what sense I will compute it. I'm going to compute the order of magnitude of the norm. So what is the order? What do I mean by order of magnitude? So well, we're working in Cm of R n, and when I write a constant C, C or C prime or any such thing, these constants are supposed to depend only on little m and little m. Okay? So let's call those controlled constants. So they depend only on which space we're working with. Okay. Now suppose that I have two non-negative numbers, x and y, which are determined by some data. The data being, for example, E, F, and sigma. So these are two non-negative numbers. Then I will say that X is of the same order of magnitude as Y. And this means simply that I guarantee that they differ at most by a controlled constant multiple. So these little c and big C are constants that depend only on little n and little m. Okay, so that's what it means for two things to be of the same order of magnitude. And now to compute the order of magnitude of X means to compute some Y which is guaranteed to be of the same order of magnitude of X. Okay, so if it's all right, I will write nothing, I'll just say it again. Two things are of the same order of magnitude if they're guaranteed to differ at most by a constant multiple, where the constant depends only on which function space I'm working in. And I will very often not be computing things exactly. I will compute the order of magnitude of something. And to compute the order of magnitude of something means to compute something else whose virtue is that it has is guaranteed to have the same order of magnitude as the thing I'm trying to understand. All right. So what I will really succeed in doing is to compute the order of magnitude of this guy. And now, so now this problem has been made more precise. Okay? And now compute an F and M satisfying this. What does it mean here? I want to guarantee that that the M that I use is at most a constant. The M that I get is at most a constant times the least possible. This is a controlled constant. Okay, and so let me call such a thing, so such an F is a nearly optimal interpolant. Okay, so it's let's say that sigma is zero. The sigma is exactly zero, for example. And let's say I'm trying to match perfectly what the the data, not up to an error bar. All right. Well, then a nearly optimal interpolant is something that matches the data perfectly and whose CM norm is maybe not the lowest possible, but cannot be beaten by more than a constant factor, where the constant depends only on which function space we're working in. That's what we're trying to compute. Okay? So now so far I've just been posing problems. I think there has not been a single theorem. Please. The constants do not depend on sigma, they only depend on little m and little n. Okay. So maybe I'll state one theorem. Well, before I state one theorem, so let me make one advertisement. So far, I'm about to state a theorem, but so far I've just been posing questions. And the remark is that there are now solutions to all of these questions, okay? Except for the versions for Sobolev spaces where the algorithms are not yet produced, but I think there's a good shot at them. But except for that, these questions are answered. Okay, so, all right, so let me state one theorem. Okay, so, up there, right? Number of points of E is N. Then we can compute the order of magnitude of the norm with Cn log n work. I mean, that means with at most that many computer operations, and at most Cn storage being the number of memory cells in the RAM. Okay? We can also compute a nearly optimal, is that what I said I call it? Yes, a nearly optimal interpolant F using one-time work at most C, query work at most C log N, okay, and storage at most C N. Oh, at most C, that's ridiculous, I'm sorry, C N log N, how's that? It's a little less ridiculous, storage C N. Okay, now I claim that this is very likely optimal. To prove that it's optimal is a very challenging problem in computer science, but let me make completely trivial remarks that show that one obviously cannot do much better. Okay? Suppose I want to compute the order of magnitude of the norm of F. I had better look at F. I had better read the data. Now, there are N data points, so it takes work N to read the data points. So it would be ridiculous to expect to less than N, and what we get is N log N. Okay. Suppose we want to compute a nearly optimal interpolant. How much storage do we need? Well, we had better be able to store the data that we're working on. I mean, we had better be able to store the data. That requires a little bit of discussion because conceivably the data could be coming to us on the fly and we throw out data after we use them. But, for example, if the sigma is identically zero, then we have to be able to reproduce the value of F perfectly at the data points. And so we're not going to be able to reproduce the value of F perfectly at the data points with fewer than N memory cells. So the storage is absolutely optimal, okay, for completely trivial reasons. How about the query work? If I ask you a query, the least the computer has to do is print out the answer is, okay, and that requires one unit of work. And here we're using at most log N units of work. Okay, and finally, how about the one-time work? Well, the computer had better at least look at the data, which requires work N, and here I say it can be done in work N log N. All right, that's what can be trivially proven. I would be amazed if any of these logs can be deleted from the problem, but that's just a statement about my emotions, it's not a theorem. Okay. All right. So in some sense, the interpolation problem has an optimal, efficient solution. Why isn't this of immediate practical use? And the answer is that, this constant, damn it, is too big. It depends only on little m and little n, but it's big. And so the interpolants produced are not going to be useful interpolants. And I think there's one particular piece, a very small piece of the proof, which is the source of the problem, and that needs to be taken out and replaced by something better. I think there is a serious chance that this could be made practical. It is not now practical. Okay, it's a quarter of 12. I've told you, I mean, I've stated questions, I've stated one theorem, I've given you no ideas how to prove anything or even what the statements of the solutions are. I've barely discussed the infinite version. All right, I have three more lectures in which to try to say something about it. So these are the questions to be addressed. Thanks. Unfortunately, it's not as good as that. There are certain constants. I mean, the algorithm makes use of certain constants. So if one were to program up the algorithm, the first thing that the algorithm would do is some little trivial preparatory subroutine that would compute these constants so that later on they can be referred to. Okay? And so what would happen if this thing were well programmed is the program would compile very nicely and then you hit go and there would immediately be an overflow error. Now you could simply take the algorithm and use different constants and it may well work just fine. I do not know. But the virtue of the algorithm in its present impractical form is that there are things it's guaranteed to do. And if you start monkeying with it just to make the constant smaller, you have an algorithm which is not guaranteed to do anything. So I believe the algorithm has to be modified. That's enough for now, more than enough for now. Okay, so suppose for instance you take sigma equals zero, you want to fit the data perfectly. Every numerical analyst knows that the trouble with this problem is that it's very sensitive to tiny changes in the data. That's why you introduce the sigma. And then whatever sensitivity there is in the problem, that's precisely how much sensitivity there is in the answer. But the problem is sensitive to little perturbations of the data.
Instead of sending to all of our energy, try to extend to a smaller set of numbers, does that become a different problem? Or is it
essentially the same? It's essentially the same problem. But you could then ask, suppose I try to extend it to Rn, or I try to extend it to some bounded set. What's the relation? Even though solving one problem is essentially the same as solving the other problem, you could ask, do you get different answers? And I'm not so sure. Yes. Yes. Okay. Very good question. Suppose that there is insecurity in the position and in the values. Suppose that those insecurities are about the same. Okay. Then, and suppose furthermore that your M, that you're interested in is such that you're looking for a function whose gradient is bounded, then I've given myself enough leeway that I might as well just redefine the data point to be exactly what I thought it was. For obvious reasons, because I'm at the wrong data point and I have the wrong value. Okay, well, I move over to the right data point and I've made an error, but that error is comparable to the error in where I thought I was. So the problem, as long as I give myself errors of both kinds and as long as they are comparable, it doesn't matter. Okay. That is a harder problem, and I don't know how to do that. I wouldn't rule out that the ideas here would be of some use, but I certainly do not claim to know anything about that problem.